Breaking the Glass Slipper, we believe it is important to have conversations about women and issues of intersectional feminism within science fiction, fantasy, and horror. To continue to do so, we need your help. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. Join the conversation by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Welcome to Breaking the Glass Slipper. I'm Megan Lee.
I'm Lucy Holland.
And I'm Charlotte Bond. Trying not to giggle.
Yes. So I think that's going to be a theme for today. So basically, we have a bit of an unusual episode for you today and a little bit of a throwback. So it's amazing that we have so many authors who want to come on the show now. We feel truly honored. But we thought it was about time we spent a little bit of time talking amongst just the three of us, you know, like it was when we first started out. See, not one, but two of my fabulous co-hosts have books coming out soon, and by the time this episode airs, Lucy's should already be out in the world. As such, I wanted to shine a light on their work with an episode that might be at times a little silly, but hopefully as good fun to listen to as it was to record. While my co-hosts ought to need no introduction by now, their new books probably do. So I am going to make them tell us about their books right at the beginning, the dreaded question that all authors seem to absolutely hate, despite constantly needing to do so. So, since Lucy's book is out first, she gets to tell us a little bit about her new book.
It is very exciting because I have been working on it for 3 years and it is finally coming out. It will hopefully, yes, as you say, be out in the world by the time everyone is listening to this. So my new novel is another historical fantasy. It is called Song of the Huntress. It is a retelling of the myth of the Wild Hunt. Briefly, that involves an Iceni warrior called Hurla going to the other world, making a deal with the other world king. Don't make deals with the Fae. That is a general rule. And unless you want to be cursed for all eternity, which is, of course, what happens to her. And she returns. Everyone she loves is dead because, you know, you spend too long in the Fae world. Lots of years pass in the real world outside. And she's cursed to ride eternally, slaying anyone who crosses her path. That myth really intrigued me. I really liked the idea of exploring why such a person would go to the other world in the first place, why they would make a deal with such a capricious figure as the king of the fairies or the otherworld king, and what exactly, you know, they would do on returning to the mortal world and finding that they had nothing left to fight for. So that is the premise. The action takes place in early 8th century Wessex. So it's another sort of West Country based novel, a bit like Sister Song, my previous book. And it's full of courtly intrigue, dead kings rising, sapphic romance, and a whole bunch of asexual rep, which is something I was very keen to talk about. So I hope everybody enjoys it when it lands.
What our listeners don't hear is that round about every podcast episode, we have like 5-10 minutes where we catch up and chat and things. And we've been hearing about Lucy's book for ages, and I am so excited that it's now finally here and we get to buy it and to read it with its lovely covers and everything, because we've literally heard about it from the beginning, haven't we, Megan? It's just been little bits here and there. It's been so fascinating to watch it come. It's like having a little baby.
I know. It's a bit like, she's saying, oh, it took me 3 years to work on this. I'm like, yeah, we know. We've been hearing about it for 3 years.
Sorry,
come on.
Guys.
Okay, Charlotte, it's your turn.
You should have been making notes while Lucy was speaking. My book is a novella, so it's a little shorter, and it's the first of two, possibly more. The first book is called The Fireborn Blade, and is out in May, and the second book is called The Bloodless Princes, and is out in October, I believe. So The Fireborn Blade started out with a knight in a tunnel going down to kill a dragon with a squire who's not quite all he seems. And it started out life as a short story, and it was all right. And my knight was a portly, jolly gentleman and whatever. And it had a good feel about it. And then I was like, I kind of feel there's a bit more to this. And also my knight feels a bit too stereotypical. So made him a woman. And it turned out to be much better. And she was a much stronger character, one that I really felt I empathized with. And I started to build in some world building. So as well as the story of Madeleine, my knight, and Petros, her squire, there are at least maybe half a dozen little dragon slaying stories within it, based around the idea of within the world is a mage guild, and they interview knights who've been out and killed dragons or been had people killed by dragons and all this kind of thing. And I really enjoyed writing those. So it is one novella with an overarching story, but there's lots of little stories in it with lots of little dragons. So that was quite good fun. And then I don't really want to talk too much about The Bloodless Princes because there's big spoilers in it. But I really enjoyed writing that one. It's a very different feel to the first one. And they descend into the underworld for that one. So I had great fun looking up all underworld myths and things for that.
Well, it's very exciting, and I'm very excited for both of you, and it's just amazing. So anyone who's been listening to the show for any amount of time, I hope you go out and buy Lucy's novel and both of Charlotte's novellas, because why would you want to do anything else, really? But all right, let's get into the meat of this episode. See, normally when we run our, you know, podcast and we're very, very professional and we share prompt questions with our interviewees ahead of time, you know, so as not to terrify them or feel like they've been entrapped in, you know, really hard-hitting questions. However, Lucy and Charlotte are not really guests, are they? So they have no idea what I'm planning to ask them in this episode. And I'm quite excited by that. So I wanted to, you know, do some fun things, ask them about writing craft, some truly left field random stuff for shits and giggles, as we say. And also I wanted to ask them some questions that really I find that most of our guests just don't tend to engage with that much. So but that's kind of where I'm coming at this episode from. First of all, I'm going to start with not even really a question. I'm just going to say, did you know that we are in our ninth year of running this podcast? What?
Oh my God. You would not.
We are. All right. But if you can remember back to the before times, to 2016, I was wondering, how have the discussions that we've had on this podcast, the interviews we've had, the people we've talked to, how have these influenced your writing? And let's start with you, Charlotte.
To be honest, I think the way the podcast has mostly influenced me is just the number of books that I've read. There have been huge books in all genres, amazing ones, ones that I've really engaged with, ones that I've gone, that's not so good, but I can see the appeal of it. So for me, I think certainly just the amount of reading that I do is so influential on my own work. When I was actually thinking up a new story today and I was making notes like, well, actually it's got a bit of this story and it's got a bit of that story. And I found the other day when I was writing the history of the Fireborn Blade that I'd been influenced by Pratchett as well. So everything you read does end up in some format on the page, even if it's just a character or a throwaway line or an idea. I think one of the other things I've obviously been influenced by is we get some great writing craft advice from all of our authors that we have on. And they say things that maybe I'm like, oh, actually, it's really good. I apply it to my own stuff. Or I go, oh, that's another way of doing it. And I try it out and then it doesn't work. But I'm like, okay, but actually I've learned that this isn't the way for me. And there's also an element of when they talk about, you know, how they struggled with it perhaps a little bit, I go, I don't feel quite so bad now that I sat and watched Buffy for 7 hours yesterday instead of writing the character plots that I should have done and things like that. So I think just hearing how authors are human, like the rest of us, and actually speaking to the people behind it. And then also we get people like Michelle Paver and Ellen Datlow, you know, complete heroes of mine. And I'm like, oh my goodness, when I get to fangirl. But hearing how they have applied their own craft and the research they've done as well just is so fascinating for me, and sometimes makes me feel, yes, I'm on the right path, or yeah, maybe I strayed slightly from the path and I should go back a different way.
There were two instances where we had guests who said something so interesting that I opened my notepad and typed it in. And I used those interesting things in my actual novel. So thank you.
What?
We've just been really lucky to have some extremely intelligent, eloquent guests whose ideas directly influenced my work. And, you know, sometimes they can put into words very beautifully and succinctly a concept that I'm aware of but have been struggling to express myself. And I think the same principle applies, you know, when you're simply reading other authors' books, when you're encountering other people's creative work. But there's something really special about it when it happens, you know, on your podcast and you've invited that author on and you've written questions and then they turn up and they say something really profound that resonates with you, not just as a human being, but in a creative way, in a way that you feel you can directly respond to in your own work. I think that's the most special thing I've found about running this podcast.
Aww. We have had some amazing guests, and I really wish we could get some guests that weren't so articulate and clever, because really, my self-esteem has just plummeted.
Come on, guests, like, just stop making us look stupid.
Well, now I'm not on the back foot by being the first one asked. I think perhaps one of the biggest things this podcast has given me and influenced me in my writing is you guys, because I'm always bouncing ideas off you. And when I've got good news to share, I know that I can send it to you and you'll be super enthusiastic. Megan gives the most excellent marketing advice ever. Lucy has always got a good historical fact or two to share. So yeah, we've had some amazing guests, but I got to say, my co-hosts are just so amazing and supportive of my personal writing journey. And I hope I provide the same to them as well, a little bit.
Aww. That's too cute.
Very cute. Thank you.
It's not supposed to be cute. It's supposed to be honest. But yeah, I mean, you guys are awesome. Aww. You're always the first people I go and tell. In fact, when I got my book deal, I was like, can I tell Megan and Lucy? And they're like, yeah, all right, but tell them not to tell anyone.
And we didn't. We're very trustworthy.
We didn't.
We are very good people.
We know how it goes. We know the drill.
So I was going to ask, though, because both your novels feature sort of main female protagonists, you know, unsurprising, really, when we think about the podcast that you're involved with. But since we spend so much time talking about women or female presenting people, I instead wanted to ask you about the men in your character, in your books instead. Your male characters, or potentially your non-binary characters, you know, in light of the conversations that we have about, you know, underrepresentation of women, people of color, non-binary people, or like Lucy was talking about, you know, asexual characters. And we've even had conversations about toxic masculinity, whether or not you agree with the terminology, the how you call it, whatever. I just wanted to know, what did you want to say with your male characters?
I'm happy to jump in here because, I have three protagonists in Song of the Huntress. Two of them are indeed women. One of them is a man, the king of Wessex. And this picks up on what I mentioned earlier about asexuality or the asexual experience missing from historical narratives. I would also argue it's missing from a lot of other narratives too, though it's been really encouraging to see some books in the genre field beginning to feature ace protagonists. What I don't see as much is men, ace men, and that the experience of being asexual kind of colliding with the expectation of, I say, kind of masculinity in the sense of, you know, I'm talking about it in a historical sense, the Anglo-Saxon epics, these stories that have come down to us from so many years often feature men in very stereotypical roles. I mean, kings are supposed to be they're supposed to be warriors, they're supposed to be physically strong, hold their drink, you know, they're womanizing, they're specimens of virility, they slay dragons, they're certainly, you know, everything that we would look for or traditionally have looked for in our very masculine heroes. And I have, as someone who is setting a book in this time period, I was very aware of the fact that I did not want to write a king like kind of the Beowulf and the Beowulf story sort of depicts. As I said, I'm really interested in the ace experience, and I thought would be really interesting to write a male character who has that similar experience, and who struggles with his identity right from the very start, you know, and who finds himself in a position of authority in a kingdom. He has a very strong wife who has a good sense of her own identity, but also struggles in her own way against what society wants her and believes her to be, namely a provider of heirs. And so actually both of them are united in their struggle to embrace their true selves in the face of a society that wants them to be a certain way. I really enjoyed Ayn is my king. I really enjoyed writing him as a character. He's quite enigmatic. He's quite scholarly. He speaks three languages. He prefers to find diplomatic solutions as opposed to violent solutions that his wife prefers. Yeah, he finds his strength through the book, but he finds it, you know, by escaping. He finds an outlet and a way to sort of express himself that outside of those very masculine narratives that popularize the Saxon courts of that time, and that still, I would argue, popularize society today. And it's been a really interesting experience writing him.
Okay, Charlotte, I think you need to bring the tone down. That was too serious.
It was too serious.
You asked me.
Well, I'm really sad that I didn't put any male dragons in, so I can't actually talk about my dragons. But the male characters, so I have Madeleine, who is the main female character. There's a sort of secondary female character called Sarahleen in the first book, who becomes more prominent in the second book. But to begin with, it's basically Madeleine and Petros in a dark cave with lots of things trying to kill them. But when I came to my male characters, I tried to write balancing ones. So Petros is basically based on Anakin Skywalker. He's young, he's sulky, he's got a chip on his shoulder. Later on, there's a character called Kenyon, who's also a mage, and he's smart, he's a little bit bumbling, but he's generally a good guy, and he's sharp and he's encouraging of women. And so they kind of balance each other out. And again, within the side stories I've got some knights who are honourable but find themselves in a bit too deep, and I have some who are really arrogant. I have some who just don't care. The second knight you meet in that way is an absolute asshole, and I was really pleased when I wrote the end of it. I'm like, yes, I hope you get a good thrashing when you walk out that door. So that he was quite good fun to write because he was so obnoxious. But the men within it, what I was trying to show with them is the overall society. So I said earlier on that I was quite inspired by a Terry Pratchett quote. It's from Feet of Clay, and it's when Angua and Ciri are talking about the roles of men and women. And earlier on, Ciri has kind of said how much, you know, she likes women within Ankh-Morpork Pork. And Angua goes, oh, well, loads of people, you know, really want to do it the dwarf way. You can do whatever the boys do. And she goes, yes, just so long as we do whatever the boys do, indicating that, you know, it was still very restrictive. And later on, they're talking about it, and Angua says, in the watch, you can be any sex you like, provided you act male. There's no men and women in the watch, just a bunch of lads. And that was kind of the feeling I was going for, sort of the old boys club. So in a weird way, my Madeleine character is also kind of a boy, because she's forced to act that way a little bit to be in the boys club, but thankfully by the time we meet her, she's just basically gone, screw that, I'm fed up with you all stabbed me in the back, I'm going to go my own way. But I had quite good fun
looking at the roles of men and women and how some men were very much stereotypes within that society and some were genuinely decent guys just trying to make the world a better place.
But I really like that you have the, you know, because obviously Madeleine is in a woman in a man's world and that she feels that she needs to adopt certain characteristics in order to be accepted and to be part of that world. And I love that you have that narrative in there, that is kind of what is expected and it's a natural response for a woman to mold herself to the, but it's untrue. And if, you know, she's not true to herself and she finds that actually she's not rewarded for doing that, the bias remains. So that I kind of really like that you went in and explored that and that she actually has to come to that realization herself.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much backstory. And the whole time when she was trying to fit in as a knight and what happened, that I could probably write a whole novel on it and it would be really fascinating how she rose to where she was now. But yeah, it was a really fascinating idea to explore this idea of old boys club. And yeah, you're totally one of the lads, so long as you're one of the lads.
We often ask our guests what tropes they love, what tropes they hate, and what ones they wanted to engage with when they were writing. But many don't feel that they do actively engage with tropes that much, at least, you know, in a deliberate way when they write. So I am going to posit the question to the both of you. Were there any tropes you were attempting to directly be in conversation with, and what were you hoping to say?
Yeah, okay. I wanted to explore the strong female character. Part of the trope that I was hoping to challenge is this idea of strong female characters being strong and this being a good thing. Because what if they're not a good thing? What if we are, you know, that these women who feel like they have to go out and adopt these male characteristics and kill their way to respect in these societies, it's not a great way. And it's extremely psychologically damaging for them. And it's also damaging for the men in their life. Athol, my queen, is bisexual, but she's, you know, in a heterosexual relationship. And, you know, her husband, neither of them are particularly good at being who they're supposed to be or who society considers them what they're supposed to be. And I was just really interested in kind of digging down into the damage that could result on a marriage from a woman who reacts against being put into the role of sort of housewife, of baby provider, that sort of, you know, very domestic role. Like how, if she breaks out of that and if she embraces a sort of alternative, and I use this in scare quotes, stronger self, how does that affect her relationship with her husband, a man who who's very much also fighting to escape this idea of what a man or a king should be in that time?
Lucy stole my answer, effectively. She's just talked about the whole point. Again, yeah, it's about writing a strong woman, but I suppose for me the key point was to write a strong warrior who's still a woman and isn't a man, isn't boorish, stuff like that. I mean, I loved Brienne of Tarth in Game of Thrones, and I loved it even more when she was played by Gwendolyn Christie, who is just stunning and gorgeous and elegant and wonderful in so many ways. And I kind of wanted to base my character on Gwendolyn Christie's interpretation and the idea that you can still be feminine even when you're a warrior and even when you're taller than everybody else. It's still possible to retain your femininity. So I think that was certainly something I was thinking about. I didn't want her to be boorish. I didn't want her to just run in with her sword and let her sword do the speaking. I wanted her to be bold, but also she's quite controlled and she uses her knowledge. And in the situations where they encounter danger, even though Petros has more magic on him, and there are magical items in the world, he is definitely very panicky and very jittery, where she's like, it's fine, just don't need magic. We don't need this. This is what we need to do. And then in the second book, I really enjoyed playing around with her ability to think about her philosophy and change it. So you tend to get, you know, sort of knights who are honourable and they will die on that honour. But I was like, no, I want my knight to actually think about what her values are and what she's believed up till now and have the courage to go, actually, you know what? Maybe I was a bit wrong.
I mean,
ooh, a philosophical night. I like it.
That's book two. Book two is definitely more philosophical. Book one's quite gory. I tried so hard to get more gore into book two. I'm disappointed by the lack of gore in book two, but there is a lot of underworld and there's a lot of philosophy and there's a hell of a lot more dragons. So that's really cool.
What sort of book, film, TV show that you absolutely love that would, for most people, feel completely left of field for you? And is there one that is just completely outside, you know, the kind of genres that we cover on the show, the genres that you're known for loving and enjoying, that also was quite influential on maybe these books or just your writing in general?
I was going to say costume dramas, because they're very, like, okay, I know I write historical fantasy, but I didn't come from writing historical fantasy. I've always been a pure fantasist. And if I watch things, they generally like the type of medieval European settings that we all know and love. But, you know, things like Gwyneth Paltrow's Emma and the BBC Pride and Prejudice, which is obviously the only true version.
Mm-hmm.
And Middlemarch, the BBC one of Middlemarch, also six episodes with Rufus Sewell as Ladislaw. Fuck, he's hot. And those are, yeah, I wouldn't say those particularly intersect with what I do creatively. You know, like they I suppose I'm very into character and character always comes first for me. And these are exactly that. They're very deep. They're kind of deep dives into social interactions. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that I, write particularly, I don't concentrate on deep social interaction level. A lot of my stuff is epic in nature. There's lots of stuff going on outside of the characters interacting with each other. There's always world, you know, the world is at stake, something's at stake, big, big stories. So actually to have a small story, and these are often very small stories. They take place in a tiny friendship group that affect a tiny number of aristocratic people. And I would say that isn't particularly something that you'd think that I'd be drawn to, but I do enjoy them.
I have to give a shout out for costume dramas as well. I think a lot of it comes from what your parents used to either watch or let you watch as a kid. And my mum's a huge fan of costume dramas and sitcoms and things. So we used to watch quite a lot of those. For me, I suppose what was a bit more left field as well as costume dramas, probably murder mysteries. From previous listeners and previous episodes will know that I'm not a big fan of ambiguity. I don't like things where I don't really understand the ending. I can't stand The Shining by Stanley Kubrick. Book, wonderful, love it. The Shining by Stanley Kubrick, like, what the hell is that ending? So I really like murder mysteries where you have a very definite ending. It all wraps up. It's very satisfying. It's going from chaos to order. I really, really like that. And then my really, really random one, which surprised a lot of people on the internet recently, is I put out a call on all the horror sites I'm on going, there was a TV show when I was a kid that absolutely terrified me. And just watching the intro gives me shivers because it's so horrible. And it's a show that I couldn't remember the name of, and somebody tracked it down for me, and it's called Orm and Cheep. And it's basically little puppets, and it's voiced by Richard Briers. And it's a little puppet of a bird that can't fly. And the bird moves in with a snail. And every episode is basically things trying to eat this baby bird that can't fly. And then obviously the baby bird escapes. But the terror and the peril in it really, really got to me as a kid, because I was very, very young. And that's kind of stayed with me. And I think, although I look back at it now and I watch episodes of Orm and Cheep and I can sort of view it from a detached point of view, I was really, truly scared. And I think that's kind of obviously where my love of horror has come from, as later on I've explored it. But I do remember being terrified of it as a kid, and that has stayed with me forever.
I love how you were terrified as a child and that made you want to terrify others.
Well, it's where my terror comes from. So I suppose it's more a case of, I was terrified as a child and I didn't read horror stories as a child. But when I grew older, I was like, well, what terrifies me? So I do a lot of, there's a lot of nature in my horror writing in particular. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of nature and society and things built within The Fireborn Blade. So And when I think back, what terrifies me, it's like, it's very much grounded in nature and obviously in demons from Dallas, you know, those are basically the things that I write about, and wolves as well. I got terrified by The Neverending Story, who didn't, and also The Box of Delights. So, you know, wolves tend to be a big thing for me. So when I draw on what scares me, I always go back to what initially scared me when I was young.
And what initially scared me when I was young was Watership Down.
Everybody's scared of Watership Down. I have a 12-year-old and I haven't let her watch it yet. I'll let her watch Jaws before I let her watch Watership Down.
It was early things like The Neverending Story and The Dark Crystal, especially The Dark Crystal, that I think woke my love for the epic fantasy storyline. I've never been able to shake that. Like, I, even though I now work in historical fantasy, my books, especially this last one, Song of the Huntress, tend to be quite epic in tone and in I suppose also in plot. Like, something about fantasy, it does, this is such an archetypal genre. It's a sort of like the individual against a much greater force, and whether that force is some grand archetype for death or mortality or simply our lack of understanding of our place in the universe. I love that juxtaposition of individual struggle against titanic adversity. And I think I first encountered that in things like The Dark Crystal, where you have a very, you know, Jen, you have the chosen one, the hero. And, you know, he's struggling against things that he doesn't quite understand. Prophecy is weird. Nobody gets it. And it's all in the cosmos. Planets are moving. He's just a Gelfling and his people have already been wiped out. And that sense of like aloneness, you know, that he is, until he meets Kira, like, he is alone on this quest. He has only himself to rely on and the teachings of his masters. I think that sort of enduring image, that has always stayed with me and probably shaped my love of wanting to write those sorts of stories myself.
So if we wrap up this episode, before we, for those listeners who aren't Patreon supporters, know that we do get a little bit extra for the Patreons. So I just wanted to have just a quick little thing about each of your, the books coming out. What are you most proud of? Because I think it's important that, you know, we just celebrate. And I think it's amazing that you've both got great books coming out. So that's it. Just what's something you're really, really proud of?
So, as I say, my book has a bit of a twist at the end, and I think the thing I was most proud of was that a lot of people who read it didn't get the twist, didn't see it coming.
I did not see it coming. Everyone, the twist is amazing. If I was Charlotte, I would also say that I was proudest of the twist. It's so cool.
Because when I was writing it and obviously laying all the, because you have to make sure you foreshadow it properly. And I was like, oh my God, this is so obvious. Or, oh my God, it's not obvious at all. People are going to get to the end and get some real cheat. But I was quite proud of that. But I also have to say, I'm quite proud of all the little bits that I inserted, because it was just, I think it was so much fun to write all the little extra world building bits and then to see them and see that they were good fun. And it's always nice when something you enjoyed writing turns out to be quite good as well. So I was really proud of that. And in the second book, I'm just proud of the world I created, because I created a whole underworld and a whole religion. And I was like, yes. I mean, I love doing that anyway. So that was good fun. But it was I was quite proud to create a whole underworld, and the food to go into it, and the ecology and the reason for it, and all. Like, I just had great fun doing that. And I think it's turned out all right. But only a few people have read the second one so far. So I don't really have an overall consensus for that. Whereas more people have read the first one and seem to quite like it. So that's good.
So I haven't been secretive about the fact that, you know, this book has probably been the hardest that I've ever written, and that I threw 110,000 words away of the first draft at the end of 2021. So I wrote an entire draft. It didn't work and I scrapped it and I started again. And I guess I'm proud of myself for not giving up and not bailing on the story when it didn't work first time. Sometimes you aren't in a good place mentally and you don't give yourself enough time to truly feel your way into the story. You don't realize that there is a story in there you want to tell, but you're flooded with so many ideas and you don't know which one to pick. You don't know which one will be the correct vehicle for what you want to say. And I think realizing that and having the courage to go back and start again with a slightly different setup, a brand new main character. I promoted a side character to main character. So that worked really, really well. And I'm so happy that the book is, it turned out to be what it is. And I managed to juggle all the subplots and get everything in that I wanted to say. But yeah, I'm proud of myself for not being disheartened when things didn't go as planned. That's what it's is to be a writer, I guess.
That's some amazing output to do all that and then to go, right, I'm going to start again. That's just amazing.
I am super proud of both of you and really excited that people are going to be able to actually get hold of your wonderful books. So I feel weird thanking you because you're not really guests.
We got guests for now.
Thank you, Megan, for not asking about cheese.
Oh, why didn't you ask about cheese?
Because I don't like cheese.
Cheese is the most amazing substance known to man, and everyone should talk about it.
Have I just started a cheese question accidentally?
Yes, yes, you have.
Well, thank you for listening to Breaking the Glass. Please stop now.
No, don't stop now. Come and support us on Patreon, where you can hear us talk rubbish a bit more.
Breaking the Glass Slipper is written and produced by Megan Lee, Charlotte Bond, and Lucy Hounsome. Please help us spread the word, subscribe, and leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you would like to hear on the next episode of Breaking the Glass Slipper.